I have a question, which I shall rephrase in a way in which I hope expresses the intention of the questioner. I think that the question basically says, because it's being translated in two different ways from Russian, and neither of them are completely clear, but it seems that the question is asking something like, is there a connection between the name of a deity and the way it interacts with our reality? And this person is asking that in the past she opened a cafe, donated it to ISKCON, and the deities there were called Nataraj, and she wonders if sooner or later Lord Chaitanya will dance his famous dance of Shiva. So the question is there a connection between the name and whether the deity with that name will do something according to that name? In other words, will the deity destroy the hypocrisy that flourishes around that cafe? Or does the deity require our help to do it? Well, that depends on a few things. I mean, after all, if you think about it, you have, or somebody has, given the name to the deity. It's not like the deity was delivered to you with a name on it. This is my name. And when you have given the name to the deity, usually the name you give to the deity is reflecting something within yourself, something that you wish the deity to be, or you, the way in which you wish to interact with the deity. And in your interaction, you are usually placing your desires forward to the deity, your wishes to the deity. So if the deity were to receive your wishes and desires and wish to act on them, then there would be, in that sense, only a connection between the name and the manifestation of activities there. And then you ask, well, would the deity do it himself or herself, or do we have to be involved in it? Well, then again, if it's you who are creating this desire of the deity to start some activity, and you will naturally be part of that activity because the deity and the people around the deity are an interactive whole. I will avoid addressing words in this question because it's a translation and may not reflect exactly what the meaning of it was, but I think that basically answers it, that you call that particular deity to you that you wish to relate to. And after all, your particular relation to the deity certainly is in relationship to the way you feel, the way you wish to relate, the way you wish to act, and it's just normal relationships with deities. So I would hope that you don't start reading into these names more than that. You know, when you read into these things more than there's all kinds of problems that can occur. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but, you know, sometimes people get absorbed in like some enthusiasm that the deity wants me to destroy this situation here or something, and others hear that, become influenced, and decide they're going to go out and do something about it, and you get into all kinds of trouble. I mean, I'm not saying that's what you're trying to do. I'm just bringing up the point. So what is, I would say, our responsibility in regards to this? I would say to just simply go on relating to the deity and let our lives manifest, let our desires manifest in a positive way, whatever the most positive way would be in that situation. Now, I have another question here, which I knew would be asked. It's a natural question to ask, considering what I was discussing. And I know that I did not carefully enough explain time scales and percentages of consciousness and all these little details to make one feel better about what I was saying. So now I will clarify that. The main problem is that we are engaged within this external reality. That's just the fact of life. It doesn't matter who you are, you have to engage in the external reality of the situation you live in. Even if you live, let's say, in some temple somewhere, and you want to avoid external reality, still you will find, in many respects, people become absorbed in political activities or, you know, interpersonal conflicts or group interactions and conflicts, because the whole environment around us, the whole atmosphere is permeated with conflict. So because of that, we are influenced by that kind of a energy, regardless of where we are. But that's not really the point I was going to bring up. Now, I'm just speaking about the extreme case of trying to divorce yourself from reality. It's very difficult to do. If you really want to divorce yourself from reality, go to the mountains, sit in a cave. That's the best way to do it, to divorce yourself from these external energies. Go up to the Himalayas, where those energies have a very hard time reaching. But so long as we live within this external world of interactivity, and that's basically where we all live, we have to deal with the energies. This creates a situation where our time to reflect in our inner consciousness becomes reduced. Because we have to deal at every moment with this reality, that reality, this situation, our concentration is being diverted. At any point in time, our concentration can be diverted. So dealing with this is a difficult thing to do. I can even give you an example. In between the break, you know, what do? Well, I take my dog for a little walk. I'm doing two laundries and drying things and fixing up things. This is what I do in the break. So when I'm presented here in this very illusory reality, you know, with my backdrop here, which has no expression to it, and I'm here in front of the camera, I'm really presenting myself here as somebody who's doing something here. In reality, I'm just here in the house doing something ordinary. In between, I go out and do the laundry. I mean, it's nothing very romantic. And sometimes I get time, I go and sit in the temple room, my temple room, I shut the doors. It's very, very unique space, very powerful meditative space, and I go into these deep meditations with the deities. And just when things are getting really good, the phone rings. And during the day, everything is just rolling, all kinds of rolling energy, so much to do, so much work to do. The mind is absorbed in all of this. It's not a question of how do you invite Lord Chaitanya into that situation. You wouldn't even think of doing it. I don't think Lord Chaitanya really wants to be involved in my management of the server and all of the disturbances there are there. He doesn't want to be involved in my doing the laundry. He's not particularly interested in being there when my dog is doing his stuff out there when he goes for a walk. Yeah, but then again, neither is anyone else. I mean, sometimes some people assist with these things, sure. But it's not like when these activities are going on, having association is an important aspect of it. It's not like social life has to enter into these work-a-day things. But in reality, there is a large part of my day or anybody's day which is set aside to practical activities. Yet there is another part of the day, or many, many small parts of the day, or maybe a few specific parts of the day which we can devote specifically to ourselves, specifically to our deities, or specifically to making connection with the divine energy. As for me, I start off every day before the deities, and I end every day before the deities. That must be. If I don't have that, I get all screwed up the whole day. I mean, if the day is really insane, it may only be a few minutes before the deities. But I've got to go there. I've got to be there. I've got to just simply connect myself with them and move on with the day. And when I walk by their room, sometimes I feel they're calling me in. Sometimes I want to go in. I spend a few minutes or seconds, whatever, just to make that connection again, that interaction again. If we don't spend some time just with ourselves, just relaxing in our own energy, just coming in contact with our spiritual energy, and then contacting these wonderful divine beings, our lives become confused. They become disturbed. Our energy gets distorted. You know, life is like a balance. You know, you have to keep a balance between all the activities you do outside of yourself, but also within yourself. You have to keep a balance within yourself and without, or external to yourself. This balance has to be maintained. If you're simply concerned with all of the exterior activities and you neglect the interior, then everything goes bent out of shape. Therefore, it's really a kind of a required thing to set aside time. Okay, it doesn't have to be every day the same time, and it doesn't have to be for a set amount of time, but set aside some time every day for you, where you contact you, where you can meditate in a way to feel connected with yourself in the morning before you start, and in the evening before you go to bed, or sometime, even small periods of time during the day, set aside. It will just really make you feel much more comfortable in your life. And during those times, you have the potential, the possibility. You have opened the doorways to make connection with the deity. You make the connection with the divine energy, with Lord Chaitanya, with Radha and Krishna, or other deities that you wish to connect to. You have the potential is now, you have the possibility. It's now open. So, I don't think it's required that one must shift the accent of one's, or shift the concentration from one's external world to the inner, but rather to set aside private time, personal time, spiritual time, inner time, and let that energy just flow you through the day. Now I've got another question here that I'm not really sure what it means. It's just simply one line. It says, why sahajiyas are being chastised? I don't know what the context is or what you mean by that. So over there in Samvartika's place, you should please kindly clarify that question a little bit more, if you don't mind. And then I can ask.
The question is it okay, is it impossible to make evening worship like at 12 at night, for example?
Because what do you mean by worship?
Evening service ceremony of evening arati to the deities at 12 at night.
At 12 at night?
Yeah.
Why would you want to do that?
Hladini is asking, she says that lately she somehow manages to do it so late, and she's asking, is it okay?
Because of her having other things to do. Yeah, well, I'm sure it's all right. I mean, of course it's all right. You have to do what you can do. You cannot do what you can't do. I mean, obviously, if you had a choice, you would do it sooner, obviously. I mean, if you were to ask the question in another way and say, is it spiritually optimal to have a worship, artik of the deities at midnight? I would say, I don't think so. It's not the best time to do things. But because it's just simply a function of what you can do, the practicality of your own life, what works for you because of your being engaged in other ways, well, certainly, you know, the deities are not going to say, oh no, it's too late, we don't want to deal with you now. But you should realize that most likely the energies in the atmosphere at that time will, you'll have to take them into consideration and negate those particular energies to just come in contact with the peace of it. So just be aware of that, that's all. Okay, it seems that I did figure out the question. Alrighty, there we go. You know, one used to, you know, in the old days, good old days, judge and criticize and condemn even those who would say they had a connection to Radha and Krishna and even act according to that question to express their experiences to others or to feel that their experiences were very spiritual as sahajiyas. I'll repeat that. That the sahajiya would be those who, putting aside, of course, those who were a member of that particular group, those who take it easy in the question of relationship with the Supreme instead of going through the difficult austerities and disciplines to get there, who just accepted their relationship and acted upon it. They were called sahajya. So this idea is based upon various assumptions that, number one, what these people were doing was not according to some bona fide literature. They were not doing the disciplines and work and austerity required to attain such perfections, and often their personal qualities, characteristics, and actions do not are not in tune with those who, quote unquote, really had such experiences. Now, if you accept these assumptions, and you accept also the fact that this has been part of the very strictly presented tradition, and therefore understanding of the judging those who would be like that is definitely a bona fide thing to do, then you would have trouble with an attainment that is not linked to a lot of hard work. You would never be able to accept that anything could be created simply by thinking about it. That if you accept yourself in a certain way, that doesn't mean you are in that way. You'd never be able to accept that. Because you would have to think that you are now very fallen, very low, very sinful, and you're going to have to go through a lot of hard work. You're going to have to break a lot of rocks. You're going to have to cut off a lot of chains. And after a whole lifetime, perhaps you'll be able to take birth again next lifetime to perhaps make enough advancements, perhaps be able to get to the point of actually having a connection. Now, I question all those assumptions, and I have been questioning these assumptions regularly in almost every discussion we've ever had, because I don't accept them as axiomatic truths. I don't even think that they are a proper representation of spiritual practice. Okay, of course, in some circumstances, yes, you can say, this is obviously some kind of play, some kind of sham, some kind of actually something which is totally opposite to the intention of it, sure. For example, in Vrindavan, you know, it's Indian culture, Hindu culture, interaction between men and women, especially multiple women, especially in public. This is all condemned. It's part of the society. It's condemned. So therefore, certain classes, you might call them Sahajya or whatever, take great pleasure in having the facility to do just that. I remember when I first went to Vrindavan in 1972, there was this parade, a procession. And in the procession was this person who was painted blue, playing on a flute, who had women hanging around him on all sides. It was pretty wild. I said, wow, this is pretty wild. I mean, after all, it's a great way to have, you know, group contact with women and still consider yourself like kind of spiritual. I don't even think that was the point, but it was a way to get away with something that you could never get away with and be very open about it, and really nobody could say anything. There were also other situations. I'm not going to describe them in this broadcasted forum, where it was basically a good excuse to have sex within that kind of restricted culture. Well, anyway, it's not my business to condemn or judge any of that. I don't really care. I mean, after all, people are doing those kind of things because they want to. I'm not the spiritual police department. So it's not my business to go around and arresting sahajas. Who cares? I mean, I don't even have to warn anybody about it. It's kind of like, if you find that fun, well, hey, that's your own particular resonance. But as far as this basic premise that you can't be something simply by thinking you are something, that is something interesting to discuss. We're talking here about the process of visualization. Now, in the process of visualization, there is an enormous amount of meditation, of thought, of intense conscious development of certain moods, of certain ways of being, of certain ways of feeling and thinking. You will even find it in the writings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur when he talks about how you enter into these pastimes of Radha and Krishna. If you look at the Vaishnava tradition in Bengal or that whole area, Orissa, Bengal, it always had a certain format, which was that you chant, you do some kind of discipline, and you find a guru, and the guru will give you your relationship that you meditate on, and you cultivate through these visualizations and actions and meditations. And the fact that everybody nowadays feels that it's like their God-given right to become a gopi or to be a gopi, because this is, after all, where you have to be. So you meditate, visualize, internally adjust your consciousness in the gopi consciousness. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, deviant sects or cults. This is part of mainstream Vaishnavism in Bengal. Now, naturally, within the ISKCON tradition, this was condemned. This was not encouraged. This was considered to be various kinds of deviations. However, major scholars who have investigated the traditions in that area, even within the same parampara or line or whatever you want to call it, there's so much you could say about that, have said that actually it's very much a part of it. But really, none of this matters, because the real point is that very process accepts the principle that as you visualize, as you meditate, as you direct your consciousness with intention, you become that. Even considering Bhagavatam, there's this whole example of the worm which is meditating on the bee or whatever that's keeping it inside its hole, which it takes birth in that way itself. Even the whole concept of reincarnation is depending upon that which you concentrate on, that which you intend on, you become. So I don't think anybody who's sane would object to the concept of visualization as creating our evolution. It is a guiding principle. They may not be aware of the practically parallel similarity between the way they express it and the way I'm expressing it. They may not be aware of really what they are doing, because they're so used to it being within a package, they have not really understood the philosophical basis upon which they do things, because they just accept it as it was given. But in actuality, if it works at all, it has to have connection to some universal principles which are connected to us as living beings, our living energy, and the way we interact with the world around us. Without reference to that, it cannot work. Okay, let's take another point, that you can't get there without a lot of struggle. In other words, by your sweat and struggle, you will earn your place. You will earn your right. You will achieve it by your intense discipline, your devotion, your dedication. And without that, you cannot possibly attain anything. And then there's another school which says, no, it's based on mercy. When the mercy descends, when you are just given that lightning bolt of mercy, all illumination will take place and you will attain everything. So in some traditions, like in South India, they're having these battles all the time between the group which says it's done by mercy and the group which says it's done by work. So let's discuss work, let's discuss mercy, and let's discuss a possible alternative. Because these principles are being used to define what is a sahajya, or somebody who says they are in a place and acts they are in a place when they are not. Because they haven't done the work, they haven't gotten the mercy, they have simply thought themselves to be in such a position. And it's manifested by sinful activities or bad, quote-unquote, activities which are against the real thing in bold letters and with an exclamation point at the end. Now let's set aside those people who wish to be Krishna and have a lot of girlfriends. Or set aside those people who utilize some excuse to engage in sexuality, let's just put that aside. And let's also put aside, and I know this one's going to be a bit of a shocker, those who use their declaration of great advancement and connection as a means to capture for themselves a position with followers and power and control. Because they also, this is not part of the process of spirituality in the natural sense of the term. It's just basically using these things to advance certain kinds of exploitative qualities. And let's talk about this idea that you got to work hard to get somewhere. Well, I question that. I could go on for another 5 hours questioning that, but I'm going to try to make this very brief because we don't have much time left. I'm sure all of the people on the eastern part of Russia are already sleeping with, you know, 2 in the morning. They got their banging their heads off of the table. So, the idea that you cannot contact or connect or, you know, have that realization unless you do hard work is contrary, really, if you think about it, to actually getting the attainment. Just perhaps, and this is what we've been doing, if you just simply relaxed and let go of all of this hard work, discipline, making things very structured and square, and just let it go and relax and come in contact with the soul, come in contact with your energy, which is your spiritual being. Just come in contact with it. Feel it. Embrace it. Work with it. Live with it. You may find you very rapidly come in contact with Radha and Krishna or other spiritual beings. I've just been corrected. It's 4:30 in the morning in the East Coast. And I'm amazed at you people out there who are up at that time and still following this from the beginning. I mean, my hat is off to you. Now, if you think, if I'm actually a spirit soul, a spiritual energy, and my spiritual energy is non-different in quality, that means I am part of the spiritual energy of Radha and Krishna. If I'm contacting my spiritual energy, I can easily, naturally have contact with their spiritual energy. By definition, it's not a difficult thing. Or rather, difficult, wrong word. It's not hard work. By definition, it's not hard work. It's just simply to relax and to experience your own energy and then flow into that connection. It's not hard work. And that not hard work is actually just part of our nature to flow into spirituality, to flow into the actual energy of love that we are. In fact, the only way to attain it is to flow into it. And to criticize those who can flow into it and do feel the connection as being sahajiyas because it was easy is just silly. Why do you have to crack your head against the wall when you can get the same thing by just relaxing? By just experiencing your energy. Therefore, I dispute this principle upon which such an activity can be condemned because it's not sweat. And I similarly dispute that it must be by mercy, that you cannot have it unless you get the mercy. In a similar way, I would dispute that. In other words, that I have to wait for the mercy. Or even worse, because it's more contradictory, I have to work hard and get the mercy. Now, I know I'm being unfair in my presentations of these different ways of thinking. I know it. I'm not representing them in a way in which they would be very happy with. I'm just simply making a point. And my point is that, yes, you can come in contact with yourself without mercy. Because it is what you are. And what you are is non-different from them, Radha and Krishna. And you can contact yourself. My God, can you imagine a God that would make it very, very difficult to connect with yourself? What kind of neurotic God would this be? I would say that these neuroses, which we have surrounded all spirituality with, are our own human creations. They are born of historic people or people in the past who had a certain agenda which they were fulfilling with their whole male work, rationality, produce, mentality, which is born of control, which is born of exploitation, and which has flowed into these philosophical concepts. Once, I think it was in 1977, I was giving a little lecture or a little discussion in Hungary, in Budapest. And the people looked at me at the end of the lecture and they said, "This can't be any good, so we are leaving." And I said, "Why?" They said, "Because it's too easy. It can't be real because it's too easy. You see, the only things that are real are very, very complex and difficult so that you can't understand them. If you can understand them, they can't be true." I think this work concept, this struggle concept, this whole way in which we perceive God and our relationship with God is just in our genes. It's this hard, hard, difficult, impossible, no way you're going to get there, so just forget about it idea. And therefore, it opens the door to exploiters, people who say, "I have seen, I know," and others who are saying, "My God, I'm looking for somebody to lead me, and this person has seen, and they know, and I follow you." And then you ask them, "Well, how do you know?" And they say, "Because I feel it. I know it. They tell me. I believe it." And in this way, people feel happy. I can't complain about that. I mean, I'm not going to object to you feeling happy and doing what you're doing. That's really not my point here. My point is that if I wish to present, if I wish to live according to a principle where the connection is easy once you learn how to make it, don't judge me for it. Don't condemn me for that, because you have no philosophical leg to stand on. That's my point. It's just an excuse to condemn something, first of all, you don't understand, to avoid those who follow you from being interested in anything else, so that you can keep them in your little group who support you with donations and with praise and with facilities and with a justification of your life. But people do what they want to do, and everybody's doing what they want to do. I want to do this. I'm not saying it's right in some absolute sense. I would never say it's wrong. I definitely know it works. And because I get experiences when it works, I continue to do it. And that makes me very happy. So I say, fine. And I hope I have answered your question.